to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwendinger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a lovely five-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk some more about recent headlines and hopefully provide some insight and analysis and practical application that you can take back to the office to help protect your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
And one of the articles we're talking about today is a listicle that has the top 8 ways to handle burnout. And they don't mention self-medication once, let alone 8 times, which makes us question the credentials of the author. All right, so the first article we're going to talk about is experts analyze proposed bill allowing private entities to hack back. And this comes to us from Security Week. So there's a bill before the House. No, it's a Senate bill, which is S-2292.
Go look that up right away.
Actually, I have it open in another tab, and it's really short. I wish other things they wrote were this short instead of, 3,500 pages of kickbacks and whatnot to people for free trade.
Oh, that is really short.
But with this bill, because this bill is so short, really the only thing this bill does is ask the DHS or direct the DHS to undergo a research effort or a study to figure out if it makes sense to allow people to hack back, or individual or private entities, as they call it, to hack back. The DHS is supposed to come back with which agency or agencies may authorize proportional actions by private entities, what level of certainty regarding the entities of the attacker is needed before actions would be authorized, which entities would be allowed to take such actions under what circumstances, what actions would be permissible, and what safeguards should be in place.
But what's immediately interesting to me is, how did this get on the Senate's radar anyways?
I'm not sure. The senator who introduces, Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island, and co-sponsored by Steve Daines of Montana. So it's one Democrat and one Republican co-sponsoring this.
Interesting.
And I haven't seen who paid these guys to off yet, so I'm not sure where they got the impetus for this.
Yeah, because this seems like such a random thing for two senators to get together and be like, you know what we need to talk about? We need to talk about hacking back. Someone came to them and someone told them that this was something they should consider.
Yeah, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And half this article is actually saying this is a terrible idea, of which I'm in agreement.
Well, come on, you don't want to go back and take over their servers and take over their Bitcoin wallets. What if that was it? What if you could hack back a criminal and take their Bitcoin wallet?
Oh, that would be awesome. I'd accuse Coinbase of attacking me. And then, you can see where this whole thing goes though.
Yeah.
Right. It ends up with playground back and forth. Well, he did it first.
Yeah. You're especially right, because so often the infrastructure used to launch the attacks is only under the attacker's control, but is owned by someone else. So like you're saying, you've got companies where I get hacked, I'm going to attack back. It's going to turn out to be a third party who's going to be like, these guys hacked me and they're going to attack me. And then the criminal is just going to walk off being like, you guys are idiots.
Right.
I see no way that this is good. I see, and especially given how much they complained about the lack of skill and the lack of talented people, There's no way we have enough talented red teamers for every company to have a dedicated red teamer who can, successfully attack back without going too far or blowing stuff up or just, turning Metasploit loose.
But not only that, but they talk about, what agency is going to oversee this, what certainty do they need to have that the attacker is who they say they are. Mm-hmm. And, what are the rules and engagement for the attack or whatever? By the time you even ran through all these things as a private company to justify that to the DOJ or whoever's going to be overseeing this, you might as well just give it to the DOJ and say, hey, I think these guys attacked me. Why don't you guys go attack them or something? Instead of doing it yourself.
You know, and you mentioned, the whole approval process too. Like, you'd have to go to the government and wait for them to approve it. And that should take, 12 to 18 months. At which point I'm sure that whatever's at that IP address is exactly the same thing that attacked you.
Yeah, I mean, the whole infrastructure could be gone by that time. And what's interesting is the framework for this whole article, and really for the bill, even though it doesn't say it in there, is the assumption that you're going to be attacking outside the United States, or counterattacking outside the United States, versus attacking another entity within the United States who attacked you. So you got to wonder about, you know, what happens when, you know, Netflix says that Hulu attacked them and, you know, wants to attack back, or something along those lines, and they have certainty that it came from Hulu's systems, or, you know, that's obviously a pretty facetious example, but you know what I'm saying here is that they're assuming foreign actors, whereas certainly there are American actors who do attacks as well. It's just not as smart to attack within the United States as it is to attack outside the United States for, you know, legal and ability for law enforcement to track you down and all, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the other things that they highlight in here is how this can completely get out of control from a governmental standpoint. Whereas, you know, if let's say that you think that an entity that either is or related to the Russian government attack you, and you conduct attacks against them, this is going to be much along the lines of the today, where law enforcement in the United States claims that Russia turns a blind eye to Russian actors conducting ransomware attacks in the United States and not taking any action against them. It's going to put us in the same light when we allow private entities on the United States side to conduct attacks within another foreign country. And a lot of this framework that they're talking about within here is around the concept of this is warfare. I mean, what we're talking about is, or what it seems like they're talking about, is kind of outsourcing to private organizations to conduct attacks against America's rivals, really. Thankfully, as I said, half of this article actually goes through and is really against this whole concept. I'm in agreement with them. And in there, they say that we really should be spending more time on just improving our defenses than going through this rigmarole about improving our attack capability. Because, you know, they say this attack back thing passes and everything. Some companies are then going to say, well, we need to, let's put some money into having an attack capability, which then that money can't be spent on defenses as well. So it's taken some money out of the defense pot and put it into an attack pot, which doesn't exist today.
Yeah. And frankly, given that everybody thinks Red Team is sexier, it'd probably be a fair amount of money.
Yeah. And I wouldn't be surprised if this starts, if this passes, if there isn't some financial strings attached to this to give companies money in order to have this capability.
Maybe that's who's helping sponsor the bill with their dollars. There's some red team firms that are trying to expand their base. They're tired of just doing pen tests.
Could be. I don't know. I guess they wouldn't have to be based in Rhode Island or Montana.
No. Nope. No, senators will take money from just about anybody.
That's true. Generally, it's only about $10,000.
I was listening to someone the other day. I was talking about company C, a multiple times return for every dollar that they contribute to officials. Completely legal.
Oh, yeah. I think Lockheed Martin spends on average $15 million a year on lobbying, and they come back with like $3 billion in contracts. So that's money pretty well spent.
Yeah. Oh, here we go. I don't know how this is represent.us. I have no idea how good or bad, but it's for every dollar top companies spend lobbying, they get an average of $760 in federal support and tax savings. Shit, I should start lobbying.
That's almost as good as the return on drugs, which I think is $1,500 to $1, I think.
This one says, for Fortune 100 companies, every dollar invested in lobbying returns $1,000 in federal contracts and grants. I need to start doing that. I bet I could pay a lot less taxes if I put in $10 or so and got $10,000 off my.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that really depends on who you are, right? Because I would like to be able to borrow $1 billion from the Federal Reserve and keep it on the books at the Federal Reserve at 1% interest. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they're not going to lend me $1 billion.
Yeah. And then you can loan it out to other people for 4% interest and just keep the difference. Hmm. For my first article, I have a slightly ridiculous one called "Are You Planning for the Quantum Transhumanist Threat?" from Dark Reading. And basically, the article can be summarized in one sentence. In fact, I'm gonna quote their title sentence. Companies should start preparing or at least planning for likely threats of the future, including quantum computers and humans who hack using implanted devices. I think this article is kind of dumb. They're saying that this is probably in a threat threshold of 20 to 30 years. And I don't think anybody in security is currently planning for what technology they're going to be looking at in 20 to 30 years, because frankly, we don't know. We'll have no idea if quantum cryptography is going to be a thing. They say it's coming, but they say the same thing about VR and flying cars and all kinds of stuff like that. Honestly, most companies are still struggling with the basics as it is. I don't know that it does them much good to start looking at how to defeat quantum cryptography.
Yeah, it seems like quantum crypto has been always like 10 years away for the last like 20 years. And I don't see a reason why it's not going to continue to be 10 years away. I have not heard about any breakthroughs in that lately. And even so, most organizations are probably not going to face the attacks from people who have the quantum capabilities now, or who can afford quantum capabilities.
Yeah, that's like a Microsoft and IBM thing. There's an interesting quote here where he talks about, if you're only a year along a 10-year roadmap, who has 10-year security roadmaps? I think the longest time frame I've ever been involved in has been 3 to 5 years.
Yep. And quite honestly, you never get to year 3 or 5. That roadmap changes annually.
I was just thinking, like, what if you're in IT and you've got a 10-year roadmap and cloud comes out? What do you do? Do you change your roadmap, or are you like, no, we shall continue buying new servers and sticking with the 10-year roadmap?
Right. Yeah. I mean, and also, what's the, I think the average term of a CISO is 18 months. So when you get a new CISO in, they're going to change your roadmap anyway. So being that far forward looking is not, well, I guess it really depends on how detailed that plan is. You know, if you have certain mile markers, or not mile markers per se, but if you have, you know, larger goals to say that you're going to reduce something by X percentage in 3 years and versus, you know, how you get there, maybe that, you know, that can work out.
Yeah, because I'm just imagining, at least since I'm mostly on the IR and content side, like, I can't go and tell the CISO, like, well, we're going to bring web server logs in and start monitoring web servers, but that's planned for 5 years from now. And this is, that'll go over real well. Like, I got a 10-year plan. So I didn't really have much else. I mean, there's some interesting stuff in here. There's a guy called Len No who spoke at Sector. He apparently has a bunch of RFID and near field communication stuff in his body so that he can, you know, pretend to be an access card, which is cool. I mean, it's very cyber, it's very cyberpunk. I don't think that's going to be a common vector for Red Hat hackers. That'd be interesting though. Can you imagine getting hired at a penetration testing company and they're like, and you're going to have to implant, you know, these devices into your hand so that you can break into electronically secure companies?
Wow. Sounds fancy. But here's the whole thing with that, all that fancy technology or whatever. You could put that into a handheld device. And I have yet to go to a company that strip searched me when I went in order to ensure that I didn't have a device with me. I mean, even working in a SCIF, that doesn't happen. It didn't when I worked there, but. Yeah, because this is going above and beyond what is even necessary, because you just stick something in your pocket and carry it in today. It's not like that is impossible right now when you have to go to implants in order to get the technology in the building or in the office or whatever you want to call it.
Well, that's why they said that this is 20 to 30 years in the future, because, you know, in 10 years, we'll have to do the stupid millimeter radar that they do at the airport before we go in the offices.
You're talking about the naked machine?
Yeah, the naked machine.
Oh.
Yeah, this helps you get past those.
That's true. I would much rather see the total recall scanner.
Yeah. That's actually what I thought of first, but I was like, that doesn't exist.
No, but that would be cool.
Yeah.
But you know what I think would be even cooler than these whole implants thing that he's got? Having an artificial finger that you flip up the tip and it's got a USB-C connector on it.
That's real. That's commitment, man. Having your finger cut off and replaced with the USB.
That would look pretty slick, though. It's like a robot.
Be real metal. All right. I don't have anything else on this one. I just thought it was kind of silly for them to tell people. I'm just imagining like going into the next meeting and the CISO is like, what are we doing about transhumanists?
Yeah. Nothing. I think our sentiment is really summed up by a statement within the article as well, which is Evolution Q's Mosca, who says, just as damaging, however, is unprepared businesses rushing to deploy technology.
Mm.
So in other words, you should be doing other things before you even worry about doing this stuff, because that's more detrimental, is if you actually try to implement this counter quantum stuff now when you're not doing other basic security stuff.
Yeah. Yep. I tell you what, though, I would put money that quantum is going to be this year, is going to, in like 5 years, is going to be this year's AI, machine learning.
I don't know. Like I said, I've been hearing about this for a long time and I haven't seen it come to fruition.
I didn't say it was going to be effective or worthwhile. I'm talking about marketing speak. Instead of XDR, it's going to be QDR. Instead of network IDS, it's going to be QIDS.
Maybe. I would have thought that would have started happening, what was it, 4 or 5 years ago, maybe even longer, when the NSA started talking about quantum computing and quantum encryption. It's talking about coming out with countermeasures and being prepared for that.
I should start trademarking those names, though, so I can be there first.
I think that boat has probably already sailed. But for the next article, we're going to talk about the title is Denial of, or DDoS Attacks Shatter Records in Q3 Report Finds. And this is from ThreatPost. So apparently in Q3 of 2021, they saw the volume of distributed denial of service attacks surge to several thousand hits per day. And they have a trend in here, but they have, 8,825 attacks on August 18th and August 21st and 22nd, a daily count of 5,000. And then on the 2nd and the 6th, as well as for 4 days in September, accounts were over, attacks were over 3,000.
It's over 9,000.
Oh, that would have been good if that was in here, but you know, they couldn't quite make it. They just got to 8,825.
They should have been like, when somebody was sitting there being like, come on, it's like 11:59. You can do it. This actually surprises me. I don't understand why DDoS is on the rise. I really like it. Typically is, unless it's a company with a ransom, like how are the bad guys making money off it?
That's what I think. So when you dig down into the article, they talk about the decision to do denial of service or crypto mining, as like you either decide to do one or the other, depending on which one is going to pay out the most. And this is something, this is a quote from the article, which I had a hard time wrapping my mind around, is that the reason that they say that, you know, denial of service attacks are profitable against cryptocurrency mining, which is, you know, the price of that has gone absolutely out of control, at least as far as Bitcoin goes. But here's the quote.
And other shitcoins.
Well, I mean, how many cryptocurrencies are there now?
So many.
like hundreds, if not thousands at this point. It's almost like podcasts. But the excuse or the justification they have in here for why denial of service has increased again is that denial of services are in demand and the prolonged supply shortage has likely led to an increase in prices in the market, making it profitable for botnet operators to resume attacks. As such, the DDoS market seems to be returning to the growth rate we saw in 2019.
So people are doing the DDoS is because somebody is paying them to. Why are people paying them to, I guess then? I mean, I can certainly see where, you know, maybe competitors want to knock each other offline. I can certainly see there's, you know, sometimes a revenge motive for it. We've definitely seen the whole as a distraction for another, for other criminal activity.
I think it's also actually ransoming the company who's being denied. You know, pay us and we'll stop, which is what they used to do before. And it seems to be that the assumption that they're making is that the denial of services are being leveraged against companies because of supply short and because it's interrupting their ability to get supplies or because it's interrupting the supply chain that they're willing to pay them off for it.
You're right. They did mention here there's been an uptick in threat actors combining DDoS attacks with extortion demands. Although, again, I think if that's a major part of it, they probably would have called that out.
Yeah, and of course, they mentioned the Mirai botnet and its use in denial of service attacks, which is the big one. But one thing that that was kind of annoying about this article, and I couldn't find anything in the reference Kaspersky report about the volume of the attacks. They mention the number of requests per minute, but they don't talk about the actual volume of the bandwidth which is consumed. Because if you recall a couple of podcasts ago when we were talking about the Verizon data breach report, in that, they were saying that if you had a DDoS provider that was able to mitigate against, I should have looked at this before we started recording, but I think it was 1 gig, wasn't it?
I don't remember.
Or maybe it was 100 gig. But anyway, it was a small amount, a relatively small amount that you had to insure against in order to ensure you that you stayed online when you were being attacked. So while the overall count may be high, if the overall volume per attack is still below that threshold, then you can still leverage a DDoS mitigation provider and not have this be overly concerning to your organization. Because not everybody is getting hit with the record-breaking 1 terabit attacks.
Yeah, I don't have much input on DDoSes. I haven't seen very many of them. I think I've only probably run into two in my whole career, and neither one of them had ransom demands attached to them.
Yeah, well, that's because you haven't worked for a voice over IP provider this summer.
Yeah.
Who are getting clobbered with this stuff, which I haven't looked into the bottom line of these voice over IP companies, but I know at least some of them, when the attacks were going on, we're losing several customers because those organizations could not
make the voice over IP calls.
Phone service.
Yeah. 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 That kind of makes sense. None of the companies that I've worked for would be crippled really by a DDoS. So it'd be silly to even hit them with a DDoS.
Right. I mean, imagine just a financial services institution whose member services or customer service reps cannot use their phones. Considering that not only do they, you know, talk to people over those phones, but they also have banking by phone, where you can call in, you know, authenticate and then do certain transactions to check your account balance and things of that nature without even talking to a person. Those would still be interrupted by that same thing.
Mm-hmm. For my second article, I found this lovely hard science article on 8 daily practices to avoid cybersecurity burnout, and none of them involve copious drinking. which is super weird. Not all of them are good necessarily and ones I agree with, but I think there are definitely some real good ones in here. The number one recommendation is track and hack your sleep. And frankly, I would even simplify it. I would make it as get your sleep. Figure out how much sleep you actually need. A lot of people have kind of mistaken ideas of how much sleep they need because we've all heard, you know, oh, 7.5 hours of sleep, 8 hours of sleep. But that's not quite true. Different people require different amounts of sleep. I'm sad to say that I myself require about 8.5 hours of sleep. I would love for it to be 6. I'd love to get an extra 2 hours in my day, but it is not to be.
Yeah, I actually worked for a guy who claimed anyway that he only slept for 4 hours a night.
That sounds amazing. Can you imagine how much more stuff I could get done? How many more video games I could play? Like, I could have another podcast.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was an X-Files about that. Where these Vietnam veterans, when they're in Vietnam, they got, you know, drugged or whatever by the government in order so that they didn't have to sleep. And, you know, X-Files took place during the 90s or whatever.
Yeah.
And by the 90s, they were batshit crazy.
I think I remember that one. Yeah. But, health, frankly, like the basis of health probably needs to start with your sleep. A good night's sleep makes everything better in your life. And you probably aren't getting the right amount, so you should probably mess with it. You know, try a little more, try a little bit less, try different wake-up times. If you have dogs, it doesn't matter what you try. They're going to wake you up at the same time every day anyways. Do things like light-blocking curtains on the windows. I think they recommend setting your nighttime temperature to between 67 and 69 for sleeping. There's all kinds of books and all kinds of recommendations on it, but sleep is super important. I'm going to go ahead and skip number two because I don't know that I like it. I mean, number three, microdose your recovery. I don't necessarily, this is anyone that's listening that I've worked with knows how much I've been talking about 3 and 4 day weekends and how wonderful they are. So I don't know that I believe in microdosing your recovery, but they're not wrong. I do believe in doing things like taking walks during the day, get up and, you know, walk the dogs, take a walk around the neighborhood. Get off the computer. One thing I've started doing in the last couple of years is I've started ordering magazines and getting off the computer for lunch. I used to, you know, eat lunch in front of the computer, you know, reviewing email or surfing the web or whatever. And now I get completely off the computer for an hour for lunch. You obviously don't have to order magazines. That's not necessarily the point. But, you know, break your day up. Don't sit there and stare at the computer for 8, 9, 10 hours, just grinding it out.
Yeah, actually, depending on how much coffee you drink, make sure your coffee pot is on a different floor than your office.
That's a good idea too. I used to bring Legos into the office and I would turn and, you know, put together Legos for 4 or 5 minutes between things or do that while in a meeting. Because I know personally, I find that if I'm just sitting and staring at the computer screen while I'm on a meeting, I will start surfing the internet and then I'll stop paying attention to the meeting. Nobody ever yelled at me for that. And I'm kind of surprised.
Yeah. I mean, there was that one video conference we were around where you had that Nerf gun you were messing around with.
Yeah, I fidget. I have a bunch of fidget things, like Nerf guns and things like that.
Yeah, I actually have a Bellison trainer.
I have one on my Amazon wish list. I've been thinking about that. And a pair of foam nunchucks so that when I inevitably hit myself in the head, it will not hurt.
Oh, you got to videotape it, though.
Then I can be like, who is that senator or something? Or there's someone from Arizona, I think, recently that videotaped themselves with a pair of nunchucks.
Oh, I'll have to find that. I haven't heard that one.
So I don't know that I agree with all of the things that she has on here. Is it a she or a he? I'm assuming it is a she.
She, yeah.
It's weird that I assumed it was a she based on some of these.
Well, I mean, in the list for number two was, you know, where is it? Have a good cry.
Yeah. I mean, if that works for you, I think that would increase my stress level personally, especially sitting in the office in a cubicle.
You can get some odd looks, I think.
Yeah. Next down the list, protecting your bandwidth. I think that one is a huge one. I don't see it on here. Oh, set healthy boundaries. Number six, I'm gonna go ahead and skip there, but that's a couple of things that I'm doing. I personally am setting pretty hard and hard boundaries on what hours I'm working. You know, I turn on the computer at 7:45 and, you know, I flip over from my personal computer to the work computer at 8 a.m. I shut it off at 6 p.m. And that sounds like that if you do the math, you're like, my God, Matt's working 10 hours a day. No, I take 2 hours in there and I take an hour for lunch. And I take an hour to exercise. Like, and I try to make those boundaries as hard as possible. Like if you schedule a meeting during my lunch, I'm going to be eating. And I'll try and mute, but you may get some chewing noises.
Yeah. And make that clear to the people that you work with, that they understand those boundaries as well.
Yep. Some of the other ones are harder. Recognize the urgency and defining your priorities. That can be a little tough, especially if you're not in charge of your own priorities, because you frequently have a manager that will reprioritize things for you.
Yeah, hopefully they can set overall prioritization and you can work out the details for what takes place underneath that overall prioritization.
Yeah.
Because the overall prioritization should not hopefully change day to day or week to week.
Yeah, no, I've definitely done that. I've definitely started doing that. If something interferes with that, I'll ask. I'll say, hey, what's the higher priority, this or this? And make them choose because they're the boss. That's why they're the manager. That's why they make the big bucks.
Yeah, most of the time they just say, just switch. I don't care. Which makes you wonder about what the previous priority really was. How important the previous priority really was.
Yeah, yeah. All right, I didn't have any of the rest of these that I really wanted to point out, but obviously, you know, feel free to review the article. And it's definitely worth taking a couple of these that you think are important to you and making sure you follow through on them. All right. I had one last bonus article today, which should only take a minute or two to go through. The invisible JavaScript backdoor. This is from a blog. I saw it posted on Reddit a couple of days ago. This one's really kind of interesting. They saw a post on /r/programming horror where a developer was struggling to find a syntax error because he had an invisible Unicode character. So if you're not familiar with those, and frankly, everybody listens to the podcast, I'd like to think they are, but every day, 10,000 people learn something new. So today is your day. If you hold down Alt and then use the numpad to type a 4-digit code, you can type one of the Unicode characters. And you see these all the time. You see normal characters, carriage returns, spaces, stuff like that. But the Unicode space is vast and it contains thousands and thousands of characters that we don't use as part of our normal day-to-day. And, you know, it's things like Korean characters, Chinese characters, but some of these characters are not visible on the screen. They show as a space or maybe nothing at all. So it turns out though, that some of these invisible characters are also classified as characters. They have a Unicode property, ID start, which means that they can be used to declare variables. So in this example, they had the Unicode character 3164 in hex is called the Hangul filter and belongs to the Unicode category letter, comma, other. Since it's a letter, it has the ID start property and it can be a variable. So they just added this variable in here into a script. And the only way to really see it is because it looks weird because there's an extra comma. Because the Unicode unreadable character is after the comma. So if you're looking over this, you'd think there was some syntax errors. You'd be like, why is there a comma and then nothing? But why does the script still run instead of erroring out? Although you could probably hide that with some interesting try-catch stuff. So if you're looking at this in JavaScript, it looks like there's nothing there other than that weird comma and maybe a syntax error. Now, that being said, I don't think this is a huge deal. At least it may be a huge deal for the next couple of weeks. Because it should be fairly easy from a signature basis to look in, you know, any kind of script file for non-printable characters that aren't carriage returns or spaces. So I don't think that this is, or as David suggested before when we were speaking before this, that the compiler can be fixed so that it will only recognize, you know, certain Unicode characters for variables. But I thought it was really cool. I thought it was super cool. That you can create invisible variables and then you can run those invisible variables.
Yeah. And actually in Steve Gibson's podcast from last week before, he goes pretty in depth on this. If you want to get the real details on how
was it this one? I thought we discussed it and we weren't sure if it was actually this one or a different.
It's a very similar concept if this is not the exact same thing. But he didn't talk about invisible characters, but he was talking about the functions, and I don't remember the details now around each one of those items, but that was the main talk in his podcast, where he talked about it quite a bit.
I wonder where else these have been a problem. Are Unicode characters available to use in URLs?
I'm not sure. I think some of them are, at least. But one place you can use Unicode characters that is actually beneficial is in passwords.
Really?
Which makes password cracking difficult.
Huh. I do remember somebody mentioning using that as part of their password.
Could have been me, because I've done it before.
Maybe it was you then.
Because I can't remember the key combination now, but I used to put the spade symbol in my password.
Oh, no, now you've told everyone.
Oh, yeah. Now I'm undone.
This is interesting. So it is saying, people are saying it's not a URL, but it is an IRI. You can encode a URI. Oh, all right. So it would not look like it in, because this one's using Dusseldorf with the U with the two dots on it. And that one is D percent C3 percent BC Soldorf. So in a URL, you can't just like exchange it for. All right. That's interesting. Well, that looks like that's all the articles we have today. Thank you for joining us. Follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.